Blog Talk Radio.
To some, a baby's babbling doesn't mean much, but it does. Especially if there's no babbling at all. Little to no babbling by 12 months or later is just one of the possible signs of autism in children. Learn more at AutismSpeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Good morning, and welcome to the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter, at Joy Keys. Also, check me out on Facebook. Still, there's a Facebook, right? Can't imagine. Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. Also, you know what? You guys can email me. I'm SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. But I encourage you to follow because I'm giving away a book today. So you might have a chance to win if you follow on social media and answer the question. This morning, I'm speaking. I have two wonderful guests. I think they're on the line now. Let's see. Hold on. Good morning. I'm not sure if this is Dr. McGee or Maronique.
It is. Good morning, Joy. How are you?
I'm good.
Good morning. This is Maronique.
Hi, Maronique. Thank you so much. I didn't want to destroy your name, but thank you so much for coming
great
on the show
to you,
this
Joy,
morning.
And Dr. McGee as well. Yeah.
So you guys are dealing with this issue that a lot of people have so many misconceptions about. And I guess let's start with Dr. McGee. What is autism? Just like in a small nutshell, if you will.
Autism is a developmental condition that is, there's no one test for it. But it often involves communication, some misplaced communications. It sometimes involves behaviors that are repeated often and are likely centered around autism. It doesn't have anything to do with intellectual disability because those are different sets of symptoms, but it's largely sensory, communication, and relational cues experiences.
Now, Maronique, I'm sorry, I'm going to say it again. Tell me how you say your name again.
Sure, Maronique.
Maronique. Mm-hmm. So when did you first learn about autism?
So the very first time I ever heard of autism was when I was a child. My mother worked nights, and so she would record soap operas and watch them, like, on the weekends and stuff like that. And so sometimes I'd watch them with her. Mm-hmm. And there was a character that had a child that was on the autism spectrum, and she had been embezzling millions of dollars from her community. And when she was caught by her attorney, she said, oh, it's not that I'm trying to steal things. It's just that I have a daughter. She has autism. She has all these special needs, and I have to put her in this very expensive school. It's the only place that can reach her and can help her. And, you know, they had a few episodes where they went to the special school. We saw the little girl who was non-speaking and would draw. And so the very first time I ever heard of autism, it was this thing that is so bad that you have to, you know, do whatever it takes, even if it means rob people, to be able to treat the condition.
Mm. And what did you think once you learned about your autism?
I realized how misinformed much of the world is about autism. And how there's so many people who are hidden in plain sight because people are only looking for what they see or what they expect to see. And for me, when my daughter was diagnosed as autistic, nearly three, my son later on, they're about a year and a half apart, and then myself, I came later. And I remember when it was pointed out to me, oh, she's different, I remember being confused by people. I'm thinking, I was like that. What's wrong with that? I understand that. And understanding what the condition was and how our brains worked was very helpful in so many ways in terms of knowing what to do and kind of giving ourselves grace and space. But I think the world has seen autism, and I'm just so grateful with how Dr. McGee just explained it. It's simply a different type of neurology. There's differences in the way you do things, but differences in bad. But the world will tell you differences in bad, but then the way that they communicate about autism, treat autism, intervene, describe, fundraise, tells you a completely different story.
Now, Dr. McGee, how is it diagnosed, and how early can autism be diagnosed?
the earlier the better. I'll take that question first. And one of the things I just wanted to highlight with Marinike, with what Marinike said, is that a lot of times parents get diagnosed after children because they grew up experiencing the world differently. And so they, so a lot of times the parents are diagnosed with not just autism but other disorders after the children are diagnosed. And so as early as possible, as soon as you start to notice, you know, maybe the child doesn't speak as well as their peers, if there's poor eye contact, not necessarily responding to his or her name, tuning other people out, not, like, doing things socially, like a social smile, you know, so those kinds of things, as soon as you notice them, have a conversation with your pediatrician. And so how do you diagnose them? There are tests that are performed about language, about sensory input, about communication skills that are given to sort of put together the picture along with the parent's picture of what's going on and what's happening in the world, sometimes teachers. But there's no one specific test, but there are a series of tests that can be given to a child to sort of help them to understand how they're using language, communicating, social skills, and activities that they're involved in that may occur time in and time out.
Now, when you're dealing with the child, you see on the TV people, you know, banging their heads against the wall or rocking themselves. How does a parent, how do you deal with that, Marinike? Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
Marinike, yeah.
Marinike. Mm-hmm. I need to write that out the long way.
That's okay. So I think the very first thing that's important for people to understand is that a lot of the characteristics that we see in autism and ADHD and this you know, type of neurology or that type are things that exist in the greater population, but they exist either to an extreme that's more, you know, a lot more, you know, like more intense than you'd see in someone else or a lot more frequent. So all human beings stem or have self-stimulatory behaviors like autistic people have. But we might do it a lot more frequently or at times that people don't understand or in ways that people don't understand. So I think the most important thing for a person to, for a parent to know is, what is a child getting at? What's the purpose of what they're doing, trying to understand? So, and understanding it not from their own perspective as a parent, but from the child's perspective. So is the child, what is the child doing and what's the purpose? What are they trying to reduce sensory input? Are they trying to increase sensory input? Are they reacting to something around them? For example, you know, so I realized with my son, my little one, he used to roll on his back, kind of like on the floor and against walls, and then he would also bang his head. He did it slight, you know, he would do it gently, but sometimes he did it roughly. So I realized that, you know, so everybody is different. Does the person have a headache, or is it too loud, or is it too noisy, or is the person frustrated and they don't have the words to say what they're saying, you know, or does it not hurt as much, you know, are their senses either more muted or more heightened, you know, like, so what is the purpose of the stim and what is it solving, or like, what is it achieving? Sometimes stopping it or taking it away is worse. Like if a person's flapping their hands, maybe that feels good. If they're looking at something or seeing something, maybe there's comfort in that. You know, some things may look socially inappropriate, but they are certainly serving a good purpose for for that individual, just like how someone else might click a pen or play with their hair. You know, but if they're doing it to hurt themselves, you want to try to find out what's creating the anxiety so that you can address that. And then if there's is there something else that they can do that still brings them some type of stimulation or comfort and joy that isn't going to, you know, be as problematic, like picking at a scab, like pulling hair, like banging one's head. But there's tons of stims. I think sensory is very huge for autistic people. And so whether it's a stim that you can see or some that you cannot, most of us we're needing to stimulate or in some kind of way, a lot of us all, most of the time, there's just certain ones that you aren't aware of.
Right. Definitely. Now, Dr. McGee, what is Asperger's? Because you hear that word in relation to autism.
So Asperger's is, and I want to just emphasize what Marina Kay said. It's all of this exists on a continuum. So there are people who have less of these behaviors and outcomes, and there are people that, and so, you know, systematically they're called higher functioning. I don't like the label, so you're going to hear me being very careful about language here.
Absolutely.
And I don't want to, like, I definitely will not, you won't hear me use the word, like, deficit. It's just all about figuring out, as Marina Kay said, like, are they overstimulated? Are they using it to organize their world? Are you throwing too much at them at the same time? And the behavior is indicated that they're, if they've been at this task too long. So Asperger's was typically used, it's no longer used in the code of a diagnostic statistical manual to denote the communication and relational of a child. And if there were, if they were unable and sometimes had difficulty communicating and relating to other people, then that was the aspect of autism that is called used to be called Asperger's. Now, under the current DSM or under DSM-5, it is called, all of it is under the umbrella of autism spectrum disorder.
Can I give an analogy about Asperger's, if it's okay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So it was named after Hans Asperger's, and it's not utilized, you know, again, in the United States any longer. There used to be what people called childhood disintegrative disorder.
Mm-hmm.
There was Rett's disorder. There was Asperger's. There was pervasive development disorder not otherwise specified,
right.
And then there's autistic disorder. They're all now autism spectrum disorder, or as I prefer, autism spectrum condition. And an analogy that I like to give is that Asperger's was supposed to be basically the characteristics of autism without a speech or communication or delay, but it was really given out inaccurately in a lot of time, and that's kind of where I think the high-functioning, low-functioning, which is very stigmatizing and inaccurate, came out.
Right.
So I would say that in the autism world, Asperger's was like being high yellow, if we're talking about Black community, and maybe TDD, NOS was like being a red bone. And then maybe and everything else was the range of Blackness. So it's like, okay, this is, you're this, but you're this much of this. You're perceived this way, or you can pass, or you're a little different. It was almost like a caste system or a hierarchy when it's not supposed to be. There are different ways that people can present. It is a spectrum. It's a continuum. But none of them should be perceived as above the other. Unfortunately, just like society, colorism really does exist. In autism,
right.
It was the same thing. And there were a lot of parents who would press for an Asperger's diagnosis that was inaccurate. And ultimately, however a person is, again, they're not, like as Dr. McGee said, they're not deficits. A person may present differently in certain ways at certain times, at certain ages, but it is all still the same condition. And it's better not to have these confusing, ways of, you know, as they said when they were getting DSM-5, cleaving meatloaf at the joint. Like, where is the actual... Just where do you draw the line?
Right.
And to just sort of piggyback on that is also everything we're in a case says absolutely on point. And really, I don't think we've suffered any from classifying all of these behaviors within the system of the general diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. But with the exception, I will say, Marina Kay, of pervasive developmental delay.
Yes.
Sometimes
because
that
kind of
is where a person, you know, due to like birth trauma or something like that, they have like lags in a few areas, and that thing diagnostically that I have missed since they changed it all to autism spectrum disorder.
Yeah.
Dr. McGee,
that.
Let me ask you, why is it that it seems that in the writings I've read that more boys have autism than girls? Do they know why? Has anything been discovered about that issue?
Why? People do not know. But there are certain childhood disorders, because all of these go under this, the idea of things that present themselves in early childhood, right? Or there are some of them, like the traditional Rett's and some of the other things, were more prevalent in boys. And I don't think that it's a factor of necessarily that girls are underdiagnosed. I actually do think there might be some gender differences, but having said that, however, there are instances because girls generally don't present with the many things that bring up behavioral concerns in the classroom, so they tend to be underdiagnosed, for things like ADHD and for things like autism, because they don't oftentimes are not their behaviors don't stick out in class and aren't identifiable in class as much.
I definitely agree with that. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to ask you because you have 6 children, right?
Yes, I do.
So how do you balance the children that have autism, your energy-wise, having autism, and the children that don't? And is there any, I guess, stress? What kind of stress that you might perceive happening with them or with yourself in trying to deal with autism in the family?
Sure. And so I guess that's one misconception, I think, again, it varies from person to person. I think all of us who are parents could agree that parenting in itself is stressful. It's rewarding and stressful at the same time. And so I think there's this impression that autism is so challenging that there's saying, oh, there's mothers who have PTSD to the rate of a combat soldier, X amount of divorces, it destroys the lives of this sibling and that sibling. And I really think it's a lot about our perception. Are there challenges? Absolutely. Are there moments of joy? Absolutely. But I'd say the same thing about my non-autistic children. I think that it's about the way we frame things, the way the supports that are needed, understanding and doing other things. A lot of times parents and professionals, without knowing it, do things that exacerbate the condition and make it worse as opposed to helping. And then as a result, you're going to see that spill over in the home. And so I think that one thing that's important is all people, no matter what your neurology, as a parent, you need to have, having a support is important, knowing what you need and knowing what your children need. So I I am not too proud to get help for something if I need something delivered. But before COVID, I was having groceries delivered to my house. So sometimes it's overwhelming going to the store. People need to implement things, self-care for themselves and their family to help when things are challenging, and to take time and not use the societal timeline is not the ideal one for every situation. But a lot of it starts in your mind. If you see it as this thing that you're warring with, you're fighting with, it's taking your child away, that's not making them different, then you're already coming at it with an element of a mindset that's going to make things more harder for you and for your child.
Dr. McGee, is there a medicine that someone can take to help aid in coping with autism and improving their quality of life?
I think it depends on the symptoms. So is there a medication for autism per se? No. Are there are there medications that might help with focus, who might help with some of the accompanying anxiety? Both from the parent perspective, Marina Kay's point is well taken here. I do a lot of parenting work because I treat children, right? Because in order to treat the parent, in order to treat the child, you have to know something about the stressors of parenting. So is there one particular medicine that treats autism? No, but there are things that can help parents and children on their journey, and it can help them sort of improve on life trajectory and what they're able to do and goal setting.
Now, Marina Kay, have you implemented any medications with your children? If so, which ones? I've read about Risperidol, Ritalin, Prozac. Have you used any of those types of medicines to help with your children's autism?
So I think that So autism usually doesn't travel alone. It usually has a lot of other conditions that one will have. You might have, there's a lot of information about, gastrointestinal things or that children might be predisposed to. Some people, seizure disorder. We see things such as ADHD and other things that people, anxiety and other conditions that might coexist alongside autism. And so I think that, as Dr. McGee mentioned, if there are things that are going on that medicine can help, Like if a person has really debilitating anxiety, you know, if a person's, you know, or what have you, sometimes, or has trouble with, you know, focus, then medications can be helpful. I personally, as a person who, you know, in addition to being on autism spectrum, I have ADHD, I take medication. I also have some other conditions as well, and it does help me. In terms of children, my thing that I'm very concerned about is that polypharmacy is a reality. And in this country, a lot of people are too quick to throw medication can be helpful when necessary, when appropriate. Mm-hmm. But for children, and especially children of color, I think people are too quick to throw medication at individuals without trying to understand what's going on. Is it really that this person is aggressive, or is the environment just too overstimulating and triggering? Do they need a tool mm-hmm. to learn how to communicate, or do they need to learn tools for self-regulation and calming? What is really going on? Do they have some kind of something going on internally that you're not aware of, a persistent toothache or headache, and that's recreating the problems? Are they stressed out? So what are some things can you do? Noise-canceling headphones or stimming devices or timeouts or, you know, things, you do things differently that might, you know, help reduce some of these symptoms where you wouldn't need a medication. But when a medication is warranted, I definitely think people should take one. But autism is a neurology. It's a type of neurology, so it's not an illness in that you can take a medication for it, because it's just like blackness. There's no medication for being black. We need a better society that's more understanding and welcoming of being black, but we don't, it in itself is not wrong.
And they're not medicating the right thing, because a lot of the behaviors that you see have to do with trauma, and it may or may not have anything to do with autism. And so when you see a kid not focusing, and you give them an ADHD medicine, but in fact their home might be a certain way, or they may be traumatized, you are in fact making the behaviors often worse.
I 100% concur, and I can say that that's the case anecdotally in so many autistic adults and children that I know who are given medications that create more things that they have to deal with rather than addressing what's really going on.
Dr. McGee, do you see more African-American children being given medication to deal with autism as opposed to non-African-American children and in your experience?
That's hard to say, but let me just sort of give you some ideas. I think, first of all, you know, children of color are diagnosed later, 3 years later on average for black children. And so, like, if anything, they're not treated as much, and they're not getting the special education services as quickly and the same types of services, because we are misdiagnosed as being behavioral problems.
Yeah, absolutely.
When in fact, there may be an underlying diagnosis. So that question is a nuanced answer, in that I don't necessarily see them over-medicated for autism. I see them over-medicated for incorrect diagnoses. I also see that our children are not identified with autism as early as they could be, and nor are they getting the correct treatment.
Dr. McGee, what is ABA, this treatment, ABA?
Americans with Disabilities.
Can you explain that to the audience?
Right. I believe you're talking about the Americans with Disabilities.
Oh, no, not ABA, not D.
No, she's talking about
applied
behavioral analysis.
Oh, I'm sorry. She's talking about the behavioral.
That's okay.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear you as well. ABA is a behavioral approach that was used pretty standardly up until just recently. And it is now the efficacy and the the advisability of using it as applied behavioral analysis is now come into question. So it's now, I mean, Marina Kay could probably talk to you a little bit more about that.
Every assessment
community that I'm associated with, it has become, you know, way more controversial than it used to be.
Yes. So ABA used to be touted as the thing to do if your child was autistic.
Yes.
Doesn't matter how they're presenting what they're going through. Is your child autistic? Hurry up and get them in 40 hours minimum of ABA therapy immediately. Hit hard, hit early. If you can, implement that stuff at home too, in the classroom, on the weekends. second mortgage your home if you need to do it. It's the only thing that's going to, quote, unquote, make the child normal. And so ABA has had a lot of different it's basically, you know, a, you know, compliance-based behavioral technique. It was formed, you know, basically a lot of what was used for conversion therapies and, like, animal training. And there are some aspects of ABA that can be utilized in general for any type of intervention or even just in one's home in terms of gathering data, information, tracking. However, as autistic people have been saying for decades from the ABA experience, that the experiences that they had in childhood through today and ignored, finally evident research is backing up what people have been saying. This is not just a blanket catch-all treatment for everyone. The efficacy
Well, because everybody's different.
The efficacy over time has shown in a lot of, you know, of assessments that it's not as, you know, people thought, oh, it teaches skills, it does this and that. We're seeing that from in a lot of data and a lot of research, you know, not just the ones that recently came out from the military, but others, that it's not necessarily having the effect or the impact over the lifespan that it was thought. And some people would argue that it is harmful, that it can be too restrictive or too rigid, and that it's not, it doesn't work for everyone. And I really feel like people shouldn't jump to any one thing. You know, every child is different. Every child is individualized. You wouldn't make the same exact dinner for every single child that you meet. You would find out what they like, what they don't like, what they're allergic to, and you would personalize, and you would try, and you would assess, and you would change things. And even that person is different. Therapies that, you know.
Melinda, okay, let me stop you for a second. We only have a couple minutes left. I want to ask Dr. McGee. Some people, I've read that the mortality rate might be slightly higher for people with autism. Is that true? If so, why?
I don't think it has to do any more for like an organic reason, if that is the case. But it often, like with ADHD and other things, it comes it paired with other things, like Marina Kay said. It often comes sometimes with emotional issues because the parent misalignment, or because organically the child might have some emotional misalignments, and that often leads to behaviors that might lead to an early mortality. But I am not—I can't say that I'm an expert on that, and I'm going to throw that one to Marina Kay.
Sure, yeah. Well, we're going to our core researchers on that. In that,
go ahead.
There's a higher rate of suicidality and accidents in people on the spectrum, regardless of level of cognition. And to some, depending on who you're reading, we are at higher risk of being a victim of trauma or a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It varies, but I don't think it's necessarily because of autism per se, but because of, again, just all of the things that come along with it.
Right. Well, you guys have a wealth of information between you. Dr. McGee, how can people reach out to you? I know you have your website. Are you on social media? Can you tell them your different locations?
Yes, I'm searchable by my name, Linda McGee, M-C-G-H-E-E, on LinkedIn. I'm at drlinda@drlmcgee.com, email, and I'm available on Instagram at Good Mental Health or Dr. Linda McGee. So I'm available on all, and Linda McGee on Facebook. So you can reach me at under my name on most social media.
And Marina Kay, tell people where they can reach you.
Sure. So if you're looking for me, my website is spelled like my name, which is spelled like More Nike. So MoreNikeGo.com. I'm at Marina Kay Geo on Twitter and so forth. And so I'd be happy to communicate with anyone. I'd really love to share with parents and listeners that there's a book called Sincerely Your Autistic Child that I have co-edited recently. It's in libraries as well as for purchase, and it talks a lot about how parents and autistic people can work together and understand and help children grow. So I'd encourage anyone to take a look for that if they're interested in Sincerely Your Autistic Child.
Wow. You guys, thank you so much for getting up early Saturday morning and sharing this information. I hope that it has been helpful to the listeners, and maybe they'll share with others. You guys have a great weekend, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I'm glad you had a chance to listen and learn more about autism. If you missed the beginning part of the show, it is archived, and you can listen to it here at Blog Talk Radio, probably about 15 minutes or so, and you can listen on Spotify, on iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, iTunes, and you can check out the beginning of the show if you missed it. You can always follow me at Joy Keys or check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. Follow today because I'm going to be giving away a book of Naeem Acosta. I had her on earlier, so you definitely want to follow so you can have a chance to win. Maybe a nice Mother's Day gift to somebody. You never know. All right, thank you. See you next weekend.
To some, a baby's babbling doesn't mean much, but it does, especially if there's no babbling at all. Little to no babbling by 12 months or later is just one of the possible signs of autism in children. Learn more at AutismSpeaks.org, brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.